Okay, this is lesson number 63 in our series, Highlights from the Book of Isaiah. And unfortunately, for those listening to this, once again, my recording did not work. Last time it didn't work because I just didn't punch the button right. This time, my microphone wire was messed up. So, unfortunately, it's just me teaching Sandy right now, and we won't have any of the classroom discussion that we had today. So, here we go. It's today's passage is Isaiah 65, verses 1 through 7, which I've entitled, The Lord Rejects the Apostate Israelites. So, last week, in the prayer of Isaiah, which we looked at, we saw that he gave a passionate cry for help. If only you would tear apart the heavens and come down. And from what we hear in the prayer, the Lord seemed very far away on the other side of a vast chasm. And Isaiah also ended his prayer with this mournful question. How can you still hold back, Lord? How can you be silent and continue to humiliate us? Of course, we've all had the experience of praying in a desperate time. And when we do that, and God doesn't seem to be responding, it's a terrifying thing. And so this is what Isaiah is displaying in his prayers we saw last week. But the truth is, God was not far away and never has been, in the case of the nation of Israel, which Isaiah was praying for, because all through Israel's history, even when they were too far gone in apostasy or just sheer hopelessness to seek him, he always had been seeking them. And when he did hold himself back, it was only to spare them the full venting of the wrath that they so richly deserved. But he had never ceased to reveal himself to them. In fact, generation after generation, he sent his prophets to speak to them in his name, saying, "Here I am, here I am." But they had obstinately chosen their own ways rather than his and sunk deeper and deeper into pagan superstition and uncleanness. And they foolishly regarded these things as superior to the wholesome, simple trust in the Lord, a trust which should have marked them as his children. And it's for this reason that their history has been such a long, dark tunnel, not because God was far away, but because they wouldn't listen to him. So as chapter 65 opens, which is what we're looking at today, the Lord speaks in the first person. And he begins by listing the charges that he brings against his people in verses 1 through 5. He makes it clear that he must punish the nation for their wickedness, a people who blatantly offend him to his very face. He can't ignore that. To ignore that, he would not be a just God. They're blatantly and just willfully violating him right in front of him. And so then verses 6 through 7 conclude with the warning of impending judgment. So that's basically how we're going to break things up today. So let me begin by reading the text. The Lord brings charges against his people in verses 1 through 5. Change. I allowed myself to be sought by those who did not ask. I allowed myself to be found by those who did not seek. I said, "Here I am, here I am," to a nation that was not called by my name. I spread out my hands all day long to my rebellious people who lived in a way that is morally unacceptable and who did what they desired. These people continually and blatantly offend me as they sacrifice in their sacred orchards and burn incense on brick altars. They sit among the tombs and keep watch all night long. They eat pork, and broth from unclean sacrificial meat is in their pans. They say, "Keep to yourself. Don't get near me, for I'm holier than you." These people are like smoke in my nostrils, like a fire that keeps burning all day long. So the one speaking here is the Lord. And the fact that this speech is given immediately after a prayer addressed to him by Isaiah that we looked at last week indicates that what he says here is to be understood as a response to the complaints brought against him in that prayer. But there's an immediate question that comes up. Of whom does the Lord speak? The nations or Israel? And as it turns out, scholars and commentaries are a bit split on this, which surprises me because it seems pretty straightforward once you sort through it. But we'll sort through this together, and you'll have to kind of try to stay with me on this. It gets a little bit technical. But many modern translators followed the example of the Septuagint and other early versions by rendering the last line of the verse to read this way, "To a nation that does not call on my name." Now, if you look up above, I have translated the verse the way it is in the Hebrew, "To a nation that was not called by my name." And if you just read that real fast, it sounds about the same, but it's not. It's different. So the Hebrew actually talks about a nation that was not called by my name, but down here it's talking about a nation, talks about them not actively calling my name. Which one is it? Again, the Hebrew is the way I've translated up above. And of course, when you make one mistake, you have to make another. Those who translate the last phrase in this way go on to argue that the verbs in the first couple of phrases, "I allowed myself to be sought" and "I allowed myself to be found," they argue that should be understood in a potential, not an actual sense. In other words, I was ready to be sought. I was willing to be sought. I was willing to be found. But again, the Hebrew reads differently. So the Hebrew text does not apply this verse to Israel. And when the Apostle Paul quotes this verse in Romans chapter 10, verses 20 and 21, which we'll look at later in the class, where he cites the first two lines of this verse along with 65:2, he relates the first verse to the Gentile and the second verse to the Jews. So the Apostle Paul follows the Hebrew text. That's, to me, what makes this so straightforward, why we would go the other way. I don't know why we would, but apparently a lot of modern translations do. A nation that was not called by my name can only refer to non-Israelites. Why do I say that? Well, to be called by my name, what does that mean? It means a nation that is known to be my people, and they're so identified with me that they're called by my name. Who would that be? That would be Israel and Israel alone. So a nation that was not called by my name couldn't be Israel. Israel was called by his name. So it has to be Gentile nations. And that clues us in that verse 1 is speaking about Gentiles. Furthermore, the first two lines strongly indicate there was not just a willingness on the Lord's part to be approached. He was ready to be sought or whatever. But that those who sought to approach the Lord actually succeeded in doing so. They sought to approach him, and they were able to approach him. So those who did not ask for me and those who did not seek me, what that basically is talking about is a desire to seek the Lord in obedience and worship. It's a genuine seeking of the Lord. And such behavior had not characterized the Gentile nations in Old Testament times. Now, there was the exception, the proselytes and whatnot, but on balance, the vast majority of Gentiles, God did not in any way take them in. They did not seek him in any large numbers. And yet, the Lord let himself be sought and found by them in large numbers after the coming of Christ. So there's a change that takes place, and that becomes critical, again, when we look at Romans and see Paul's argument later. So the Lord points to this acceptance of the Gentiles as proof that he's willing to be approached. That's how the argument is going here. He's writing to the Jews. He's responding to Isaiah's prayer. He's responding specifically to God. Where are you? Why didn't you not come? Why we were looking for you? Why did we not find? And the Lord's saying, I am available. In fact, I am such an available God that I even took in the people you think of as the dirty, wretched Gentiles. And they sought me and they found me, or at least that's going to happen in a future time. I'm available. Indeed, he actively called for their attention, these Gentiles, by saying, here I am, behold me. And he'd done the same thing with Israel over and over. I give you several references there where you have that very language used. Here I am, behold me, I'm here, I'm available. Through the proclamation of the gospel, the Lord drew to himself those Gentiles who had previously, in Old Testament times, been unaware of him. So if he did that, how much more, this is a much more argument, would his approachability, invitation, and welcome have been extended to his covenant people if they've not persisted in their rebellion. So it's on them. It's not on God. And as it turns out, introducing the nations here in this verse also anticipates their inclusion in the final scene of Isaiah in chapter 66, verses 18 through 24. And of course, there's been a buildup for that. Isaiah has already mentioned several times the inclusion of the Gentiles, but that's kind of the grand finale. And this is once again putting the Gentile inclusion in the spotlight. So then we get to verse 2. I spread out my hands all day long to my rebellious people who lived in a way that is morally unacceptable and who did what they desired. So here, the Lord now, after having talked about Gentiles in verse 1, now he's going to review his dealing with Israel. The verse 1 was just an illustration to Israel of his approachability. Now he's going to talk about why they have a problem. He says, I spread out my hands all day long. To spread out one's hands was something that people did as a gesture of prayer and supplication to God. We see this over and over in the Old Testament. Apparently, we don't particularly tend to follow this posture in prayer. I suppose some people do at times, but generally speaking, we think of postures like kneeling or something like that. But when they prayed, it specifically mentions they raised their hands in supplication to God as sort of a way of physically showing, I'm asking, my arms are open to you. And actually, Ezra has them kneeling and raising their hands. I know in modern times, it's, you know, people tend to do the open hand thing in music, but in the Old Testament, it was specifically seemed to take place in prayer. But here, we have a startling reversal, because it describes the Lord spreading out his hands in supplication to his people. It's normally supposed to be the other way around. They should have been spreading out their hands asking him, but he has to do it to them because they're not on board. And it says he does this continually all day long as he entreats the people, invites them to listen to his message, respond. However, no avail. No reaction is forthcoming from this rebellious people. And the Israelites are defiantly rebellious in their disposition. It says they lived in a way that was morally unacceptable because what they were doing was contrary to the Lord's commands, and it would ultimately lead to their death. They were stubbornly determined to carry through on what they desired for themselves rather than what God desired of them. And this is at a fundamental level the basis and cause of all rebellion against God. You can think of a lot of different kinds of sins, and you can think of a lot of different outcomes further downstream, but at the base level, when people are displeasing to God because they want what they want rather than what God wants from them. And that's what it was true of this people. Verse 3 says, these people continually and blatantly offend me as they sacrifice in their sacred orchards and burn incense on brick altars. So he gives a general description of people's misconduct, followed by a list of specific offenses. And from what we know historically, this is an accurate description of Israelite behavior prior to the Babylonian exile. It would be an accurate description of the Israelites in Isaiah's day, all the way up until the Babylonian exile. It seems like the Babylonian exile broke them of some of these behaviors. But prior to that, this is the kind of behavior God saw over and over and over. These people continually and blatantly offend me, he says. This describes acting in a deliberately infuriating manner, particularly by worshiping idols, which stirs up divine wrath. And so we have a lot of instances of that, like in the book of Deuteronomy talks about God's wrath being stirred up, especially by idolatry. They were brazenly engaging in worship that had been prohibited by the Lord. So those who engaged in these idolatrous activities, as it turns out, were not the least bit hesitant to acknowledge their involvement in these things, arguing they were permissible. So there was no shame here. In fact, they were proud of what they were doing, which makes it all the worst. And so it describes what they're doing, and we sometimes have a hard time connecting. What are they talking about here? They sacrifice in their sacred orchards. Well, the Israelites would go to certain sacred groves of trees whether it would be specifically evergreen trees, which were viewed as symbols of life by a lot of the pagan cults, Canaanite pagan rituals, for example. And I guess the Israelites saw this and they said, well, we'll go worship our God, but we'll go worship him where they worship their gods. They kind of did a little bit of a mixing of pagan religion with God, and that doesn't work with God. So just as the orchards were an unauthorized place for sacrificing, so bricks were an unauthorized material for an altar. And you may be familiar with this, or it may be surprising, but there are several texts in the law where it says, if you make me an altar of stone, you must not build it of stone shaped with tool. That's what a brick is. A brick is usually a stone chiseled into a particular nice square. Maybe it's molded or whatnot. But he says, if you use your tool on it, you've defiled it. For whatever reason, God, when an altar was made to him, he wanted it made out of tools that were untouched by human tooling. He just wanted a raw, uncut rock. It was possibly for some teaching purpose. Whatever reason, God told them to do it this way, and they decided not to. Later on, Isaiah will make further condemnations, but he starts here with basic violations of religious practice. I mean, downstream, much worse things happened, and we could almost look at this and think, well, this seems a bit minor, but disobedience is a big deal. And one of my commentaries observed, disobedience often begins at a point where obedience would be easy, but we don't think it's important, so we don't do it. I thought that was a profound point. We're going to bring that up in a discussion time. Verse 4, they sit among the tombs and keep watch all night long. They eat pork and broth from unclean sacrificial meat is in their pans. So the catalog of offenses continues as he next condemns the practice of necromancy. Now, this is not a term we use a lot in our world, but it's a thing. It actually is a thing even in our own world. I define it there. Necromancy is where they attempted to obtain information about the future by contacting dead. And where I see it in our world is, you know, they have these seances where, you know, they're going to, you know, get in a dark room with a candle and try to have a conversation with dead Uncle Joe or something. You see a little bit of that. But in any case, it was a common practice in the ancient world, and it was forbidden in Deuteronomy 18:11. God did not permit them to try to make connection with or talk to those who had died. It says they sit among tombs in an attempt to get close to the spirits of the dead who were buried in the tombs. They keep watch all night long. This refers to the pagan practice of staying overnight at a shrine or some sacred spot. Maybe it would be among tombs in an effort to establish contact with the deity worship. All this is just various forms of pagan practices that were common in the day. And the Israelites, this particular group, has decided to incorporate those pagan practices into their worship of Yahweh, which then becomes not worship at all. Of course, we all know consumption of pork was forbidden in the law. That's not something we're unfamiliar with. And then there was the idea of unclean meats, and they were engaging in those as well. So basically, Isaiah is describing what he saw around them as the Israelites adopted Canaanite pagan practices and abandoned the distinctive worship by which the Lord had marked them out as a special people. He had things set up a certain way to be done by a certain way, and that was the way it was supposed to work. It was going to set them apart, make them distinct, and instead they wanted to fit in with the pagan cults around them, and so they just did a sort of a syncretism, a sort of adopting of local pagan practices and mixing it with their own. They say, keep yourself, don't get near me, for I'm holier than you. These people are like smoke in my nostrils, like a fire that keeps burning all day long. So the words you're seeing here are words spoken by, in a rather sanctimonious fashion, by the false worshipers, warning any who approach them, keep yourself, don't get near me. Why are they saying that? Well, they're unashamed of their perversion of true worship because they consider their conduct to be a legitimate expression of religious freedom. And not only that, They believed that these distinct religious practices actually made them superior to those who didn't join them. I'm holier than you. And not only that, but that the physical contact with others who hadn't joined them and weren't in that superior status may have ended up polluting them. So stay away from me. We're better than you are. It's just, again, it's hard to imagine getting any worse. So these false worshipers constitute a permanent irritant to the Lord. It says these people are like smoke in my nostrils, like fire that keeps burning all day long. Anybody who's been, and we all have had this experience, you're standing by a campfire and you're roasting a marshmallow or a hot dog, and the smoke gets in your nose and eyes, and it's like, ah! And that's basically God's reaction to what's going on here. Ah! And it's like the fire keeps burning all day long. It keeps getting smoke in your eyes all day long. You can't get away from it. Well, this brings us to verses 6 and 7. Impending punishments for those who engage in false worship. Look, it's written before me. I will not keep silent, but will pay them back. I'll pay them back exactly what they deserve for your sins and your ancestors' sins, says the Lord. Because they burned incense on the mountains and offended me on the hills, I will punish them in full measure. So these remaining two verses of the section develop the thought that God will not remain passive in the face of prevailing sins that stain his people. He has recorded their misdeeds. It's interesting, the wording there is written before me. I think perhaps the book of Revelation, and you have the book and in the books, and, you know, it's as though God has recorded all the deeds. And it's not that God needs to write it down to remember it. It's just illustrating that God has a log, mental log, if you will. He knows every single thing, and he keeps track and is aware of everything that's happening, and he's going to deal with it because the recorded misdeeds call for action. They're scheduled for attention. Maybe he won't do it today, but there's coming a day when he's going to deal with all this. God will not remain inactive. I will not keep silent. I will pay them back exactly what they deserve. For your sins and your ancestors' sins, says the Lord, because they burned incense on the mountains and offended me on the hills, I will punish them in full measure. Israel had not learned from their punishment. He had meted out punishment even in time, but they didn't learn. Their sins had accumulated over the years. Their ancestors had demonstrated similar wickedness. This is not a new practice. Solomon, for example, was criticized for offering sacrifices on high places. We have this passage. Solomon demonstrates his loyalty to the Lord by following the practices of his father David. That's a good thing. Except he offers sacrifices and burnt incenses in high places. That's a bad thing. Solomon was kind of a mixed guy in a lot of ways. God considers the worship of false gods, the burning of sacrifices on mountains, a direct affront to him. He says, they've offended me, is the wording he uses here. So that's our passage, and now I want to take a brief moment to take a look at the Apostle Paul and his citation of Isaiah 65, 1 through 2 and Romans 10, 20 through 21. So I'm going to put the passages side by side. Here's Isaiah 65, 1. I've done a little bit different translation, but you'll still recognize it. I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. I was found by those who did not seek me. To a nation that did not call on my name. By the way, notice they mistranslated the Hebrew there, but that's all that's not the point it's quoted. I said, here I am, here I am. All day long I've held out my hands to an obstinate people who walk in ways not good, pursuing their own imaginations. And so here is Romans 10, and I back up just a little bit to get the context, and we'll walk through this in a minute. Again, I asked, did Israel not understand? First, Moses said, I will make you envious by those who are not a nation. I will make you angry by a nation that has no understanding. And Isaiah boldly says, I was found by those who did not seek me. I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. But concerning Israel, he says, all day long I've held out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. So you see the highlighted part there is the portion he picked up for the highlighted stuff above. And he said, it's Isaiah, and of course we know it's Isaiah 65, 1 and 2, and he just picks up the first phrase in each case. And notice he talks about Isaiah boldly said, I was found by those who did not seek me. I revealed myself to those who did not ask me. They were talking about Gentiles. But then he said, but concerning Israel. So in verse 2, he changes gears and goes back to Israel. That's how I could be so confident. That's what he's talking about, because Paul tells us here. So the Apostle Paul's citation of Isaiah 65, 1 through 2 in Romans 10, 20 through 21, occurs in a section of Romans where he's discussing the rejection of the Jews and inclusion of the Gentiles as God's people. Now, we've looked at this several times because it keeps coming up in Isaiah. Paul, in that section, quotes Isaiah quite a bit, and he does it again. So we're familiar with this idea that in the time of the New Testament, it was a shocking surprise that when the Messiah finally comes along, the Jews, who've been God's people all along, reject him, and the Gentiles, who have been rejecting God and never even knew him, are coming to Jesus in groves. And Paul is having to explain, why is that? In Romans 9 through 11, and he goes through a series of arguments and explanations and comes at it from a number of different angles, and this is just part of that. And in his discussion of this issue, one of the things Paul points out is that Israel should have understood from their Old Testament scriptures that there would come a time in history when they, the Jews, would reject God and God would reveal himself to other nations instead. So he's addressing it because it's shocking and surprising, but he's going, should it be? If you'd read your Old Testament carefully, it was there. And so Paul goes on to cite two Old Testament scriptures to make that point. And one of them, of course, is our text in Isaiah. And so I'll just walk you through it again. I read it to you, but I want to walk you through it again. It's just a repeat of what he's doing here up at the top. So here's our text, starting in 10:19. Again, I asked, did Israel not understand? Not understand what? They did not understand that they would reject God and God would turn to the Gentiles. They should have. Paul cites two places in the Old Testament where such an event was predicted. The first place is in Deuteronomy. So he says, first, Moses says, Deuteronomy 32:21, I, God, will make you, Israel, envious by those who are not a nation. That is not a nation that belongs to me, is the implication. That would be the Gentiles. I, God, will make you, Israel, angry by a nation that has no understanding. And of course, in the Old Testament, that would be, again, the Gentiles, though that's going to change in the New Testament. And in verse 20, we have a citation from our text. And Isaiah boldly says, in Isaiah 65, 1, I, God, was found by those who did not seek me. That would be the Gentiles. I, God, revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. That would be the Gentiles. But concerning Israel, all day long I held up my hands to a disobedient, obstinate people. So there it is, right there, the very thing that was happening. And Paul said it was in the Old Testament the whole time. Well, next time I plan to cover the new heavens and the new earth. I'm guessing we have about two lessons left. There's this section here, and then there's another section at the very end of the chapter that talks about the new heaven and the new earth. The final state even includes a bit of a judgment passage and so on. So we're definitely getting very close to wrapping up. I have my class discussion questions, and unfortunately, the class is not here, but I'll read the questions and maybe try to remember some of the discussion. So in my discussion of the minor, quote-unquote, violations, for example, making an altar out of bricks rather than uncut stones, of the minor violations of the false worshipers addressed in our text today, I made the point, actually one of my commentaries did, and I just picked it up, that disobedience often begins at a point where obedience would be easy, but we don't think it's important, so we don't do it. And so my first thing to think about is, do you find this to be true? Meaning for yourself. And I don't expect anybody to necessarily share on that, so I'll ask the follow-up question. Can you think of any examples where this is happening in modern churches, where people adopt a practice that goes against what God has commanded because it goes against our modern sensibilities? And so to us, it doesn't seem like a big deal. And I think in the discussion time, I'm thinking this is where we had a discussion about, I think Tim Kennard brought up the music idea, and he felt like Christians try to turn music in the worship service into a concert. I can't remember if he brought it up on this question or the next one. And Paul brought up, or Pastor brought up, the recent decision by the Southern Baptists to allow women to be preachers in the Southern Baptist Convention, something that has not been allowed in the past. In order to be able to be a member of the Southern Baptist Convention, you had to not allow a teacher, although they've been allowing it, which is why it's starting to gain traction. Anyways, there's a thing that goes against our sensibilities.
An easy thing to do, but we don't do it, leads to women pastors, which is wives submitting to their husbands.
Yeah, I mean, if we think about this...
I mean, none of this stuff is really easy in the sense of day-to-day living, but it fits your category.
Yeah, but it's straightforward. It's something that, you know, if you don't nip it in the bud, then it's going to cascade and you'll end up in an entire pattern of sin that's interconnected and complicated and much harder to pull out of. That's kind of the idea. So the other thing I brought up in our lesson was we saw that the false worshipers that the Lord condemned were unashamed of their perversion of true worship because they considered their conduct to be a legitimate expression of their religious freedom. And so I cite here the Second London Baptist Confession of 1689, not that I'm making it the standard of all standards, but it is a good place where basic biblical teachings are expressed in many ways. And in particular, they say, the acceptable way of worshiping the true God is instituted by himself and so limited by his own revealed will that he may not be worshiped according to the imagination and devices of man, nor the suggestions of Satan, under any visible representations or any other way not prescribed in the Holy Scriptures. And so I'd ask, you know, are there limits to what we can do in our worship services? And this is the big question of the ages, and this is called the regulative principle. It's been debated much in church history. There have been a lot of different directions people have gone with it. But it's you know, God gives certain things that are supposed to take place in our worship services, songs, hymns, spiritual songs. There's the preaching of the word. There's prayer. There's, you know, various other things. But then people get creative and they want to add a little something to it, or, you know, so we had some discussion on that. And I can't remember because the questions are similar. There's a lot of overlap. So this may be where the song service stuff came up. I forget. We had a lot of discussion about music, and some people felt like, you know, the music should be aimed at the head, not the heart, and so forth. And I don't know if I agree with all that, but it was just helping people process and think through that. And I wish I could reproduce the discussion, and I wish that my microphone had worked so you could hear how that unfolded, but unfortunately, it didn't take place. So there we go. That's our lesson today, as re-recorded by me.